This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Conflicts in the Middle East have persisted for years, with fighting often presented along religious lines, resulting from supposed ancient hatreds between the two main Muslim groups, the Sunnis and the Shias. But our guest today says it's complicated. We're talking this hour with Genevieve Abdo, a fellow at the Atlantic Council and the Brookings Institution. Abdo was formerly the liaison officer for a United Nations initiative on improving relations between Islamic and Western societies. Before joining the UN, she was a foreign correspondent for 20 years, focusing on the Middle East and the Muslim world. She was the first American journalist working in Iran after the revolution, who was forced to flee the country after the regime threatened her with prosecution. Abdo is in New Hampshire with the World Affairs Council this week as part of its Spring Global Tipping Point series. She spoke last night at UNH Manchester on A House Divided, Islam in Today's Middle East. Today in The Exchange, how the Sunni-Shia schism is fracturing the region. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments about this are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Genevieve Abdo, it's really nice to meet you. Thanks for being here. Welcome to New Hampshire.
Thank you, Laura. It's great to be here.
Well, before we get into the Sunni-Shia split and what it's all about and how much it's affecting things in the Middle East, let's just paint a map for folks, Genevieve, if we could, of the Middle East and the big actors there. Which governments are Sunni-dominated? Which are Shia-dominated? So just going down the line, okay, Saudi Arabia, Sunni, right?
Sunni majority. And Sunni government.
And we should say, I'm glad you raised that point, we should say that even though we're going to talk about this government is Sunni and that government is Shia, within the borders of these countries, there are lots of groups of other religions.
Yes.
So Saudi Arabia, a big actor, Sunni-dominated. Iran, Genevieve.
Shia. Very few Sunnis.
Very few Sunnis. Iraq, complicated, right?
Complicated. Majority Shia.
In the government.
Right. Even though they lived, of course, under Saddam Hussein for decades, who was a Sunni.
And the Sunnis were in power there.
That hasn't been true since the U.S. invasion, of course, which is part of the problem.
Which we will definitely talk about. Okay, so presenting this map again for folks, Syria, Genevieve.
Syria. Alawite government, which the Alawites are considered Shia, leading a majority Sunni population.
Okay,
the
that's
Alawites
tricky.
Are only about 20% of the population, and that's probably a high figure.
And that was the case in Iraq, too, where you had a minority religion leading a country
absolutely.
Dominated by a population of the other group. Okay, so Turkey.
Turkey, Sunni. There are some Shia in Turkey called Alevis. So sort of a different terminology that's used for Alawites. There are some Alawites in Turkey. But, of course, the majority, vast majority of the population is Sunni.
The Kurds.
Kurds are Sunnis.
Okay. See, I didn't know that. All right. And they play an interesting role in Turkey and in Iraq, and we'll definitely get to that. How about Yemen? We've heard a lot about Yemen lately.
Yemen is mixed. Again, that's part of the conflict. And the Shia now are ascending in power. Again, it sort of mirrors the transnational nature of what we're talking about because, you know, the conflicts that have arisen and emerged between the Shia and the Sunni sort of started in one country and then spread to other countries.
Kuwait.
Kuwait is Shia and Sunni.
And how about the government? Is it dominated by one or the other?
the Kuwaitis have done a very good job at integrating both communities in politics. So that's why in Kuwait, there's more tension now after the Arab uprisings between the Shia and the Sunni, but certainly nowhere near the degree that it happens other places, because the Shia have been integrated into the government. They've been allowed to run in parliament. They're members of parliament. So there's much more of an inclusive kind of approach to politics in Kuwait.
Well, that's encouraging to hear.
No, it is encouraging. And that's, you know, to some degree, Kuwait has been viewed as somewhat of a success story, even though that's less true now. But also the conditions are different. So we can talk about that later. But you don't have this kind of tension in Kuwait that you have in other places.
Two more countries, Geneve, Jordan.
Jordan, Sunni.
And Egypt?
Sunni.
And how about some of the other actors that we hear about? Not necessarily countries, but ISIS.
ISIS, of course, is Sunni, and they're very anti-Shia. And if you notice from all the horrific things they've done, one of the many things is that they have, you know, beheaded and killed Shia because they consider them a threat.
ISIS. So ISIS is Sunni. And can we assume that ISIS gets some backing from Saudi Arabia, which is known to promote Sunni causes?
We have to be a bit careful because it's unclear, even according to U.S. intelligence, among the Saudis who funds extremists. You know, this is an idea that's always tossed about in the media. It's probably more individuals than it is the actual state. But certainly there are even some extremists allowed to speak very freely in Saudi Arabia. So they're sort of given free rein by the state. But it's very unclear with all these groups, whether it's ISIS, whether it's Al-Qaeda, who actually funds them. But we can assume that there is Saudi funding, but who exactly is a big question.
Is it the government or is it rich people who
live
in Saudi Arabia? Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda is Sunni, and very much so. And if you recall, the origins of Al-Qaeda are in Egypt in the 1970s. That's some of the people that eventually became the leadership of Al-Qaeda, this famous physician, Zawahiri, even though Osama bin Laden was Saudi, of course, but many of the other very important leaders who still exist today, still alive today, are from Egypt.
Last group, Hezbollah.
Definitely Shia. Hezbollah is a Shia political movement. It was created with the cooperation of Iran after the 1979 revolution. And the idea behind Hezbollah has changed a lot since the war in Syria because, of course, they're very much involved in keeping Assad in power. But it has become much more of a Shia militia than it was in the past. In the past, it's been, of course, a fighting force because we all know that they fought the Israelis for many decades since the 1980s. But it served as a political movement, so they're very involved in politics and Lebanese politics. But what has changed is that since Syria, now they consider themselves, say, even defenders of Shia in other countries. And that's something that's very important in terms of how it has changed the Middle East.
One more group, Hamas.
Definitely Sunni.
We're going to put a map of all these countries and their religious domination up on the web so people can check it out. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And it's just easier to understand the region when you understand where all these people are coming from in terms of religion. Here's my big question for you then, Geneve, and I know you talked about this last night too at UNH Manchester. How much are the many conflicts that we see in the Middle East today about religion, and how much are they about political power, control of territory?
They're about both, of course. But the subject of my research, and I just finished a book on the Shia-Sunni conflict, which is coming out in December by Oxford, is about the religious part of this. So I think, you know, a lot of the media in Syria, in Iraq, is focused more on politics. So all these people are fighting each other because they want territory, because, you know, the Sunnis now have captured this city, or the Shia have now captured that town, or ISIS has captured Mosul in Iraq. But actually, for some people, and I want to qualify this, it is about religion. Even if you look at some of the non-state actors, as we call them, who aren't part of ISIS or aren't part of a real structured group, if you go online, for example, where a lot of these conversations happen, so a lot of the conflicts actually are going on, conversations 24/7 online in Arabic, some even in English. And if you look at the Arabic, as I have done as part of my book research, you see the religious references. So these people aren't just talking about politics. They're talking about what happened 1,400 years ago. They're talking about what's called the assassination of their leading imam. For the Shia, this is very important, very important. It's part of their identity. They mourn and commemorate the death of Hussein, as he's called, every year for 10 days. So it's not just something that happened 1,400 years ago. It's something that people live every single day of their lives, at least for some Sunnis, Shia. So it's to say it's only about politics is really simplifying the situation.
Well, and we'll dig into that a little bit more in a minute about whether it's about politics, how much that does play a role. But so since you're bringing us there, let's go there. What is the big difference between Sunni and Shia? I mean, they're both Muslims, so.
Right. There are slight differences in how they practice the faith, but the fundamental difference is when the Prophet Muhammad died a long, long time ago, of course, he's the spiritual leader of all Muslims, there was a dispute over whether his successor should be a relative, so from his bloodline, or whether his successor should be what's called one of his companions, so a person who advised him, who was knowledgeable.
A disciple, we would
say,
in Christianity.
Exactly, exactly, a disciple. So that was the difference. And for a short time, it was a relative who succeeded him, but that person was died, and then his son came to power, and he was assassinated. So that is what the martyrdom became for the Shia. And the Sunnis then took over and demanded that the successor not be a relative. And so that became really the dispute that exists to this day. But the Shia feel that they, because they are a minority in most countries in the Arab world, so we want to make this clear, because Shia and Sunni exist everywhere, okay, in Pakistan and many other countries, but we're just speaking about the Arab world. In most countries, they're a minority. So this assassination of their leader by the Sunnis, in addition to centuries of minority status, marginalized repression, not given equal rights, this has led to where we are today. It's almost as if for some Shia, it's almost like the civil rights movement in the United States. I mean, I hate to use that comparison, but this is the kind of discrimination that they have experienced and that has been imposed upon them for many centuries in some Arab countries.
So it was 1,400 years ago that this basic dispute took place. And it sounds like there is some politics there, too, that this minority was repressed and so forth. And after a long time, that starts to burden people. What about the religion itself, though, Genevieve? Do Sunnis and Shia practice differently? I mean, if you go into a Protestant church and a Catholic church, there are similarities, but there are differences, too. You know you're in a Catholic church or a Protestant church.
Not so much so. I mean, the difference really is in religious authority. Who has religious authority? So that is, I think, one of the main differences. For example, in Shia Islam, in Iran, for example, where I lived for many years, if you go to visit a cleric, so I spent a lot of time when I was there going to a city called Qom, and that's the city where the seminaries are and where all the clerics are educated. These people study for 15 to 20 years to be not even an ayatollah, because there are very few ayatollahs. This term is always used, you know, or tossed around. You have very few religious scholars ever reach the level of ayatollah. But even a normal seminary student, they study for years and years and years. It's a very strict education. The same exists in Sunni Islam, but the difference is that you can project yourself in, say, Egypt, as being a sheikh. If you live in a community, so when I was in Egypt, I did a lot of reporting when I was a journalist and research in an area called Mbaba, which is a very impoverished area. And there were many people that the community called sheikhs. I mean, a million people lived there. But they didn't have religious education. So they would give all kinds of religious advice to people. You want a divorce? This is Islamic. This is not Islamic. Do this, do that. You know, people would ask all kinds of questions about daily life. And these self-appointed, we should call them, or if you want to call them freelance sheikhs, would give religious advice. That is less true in Shia Islam because there's much more of a strict hierarchy. So that's really the difference. In Iran, for example, you rarely are allowed, if you're a religious scholar, just to go to a mosque and start preaching. Okay, it has to be, you have to have a license by the state. In some cases, most cases, the sermons have to be approved by the state. It's very regulated. Wow. Very, very, very regulated. In Sunni Islam, that's the problem that Mubarak had in Egypt and what El-Sisi, the current president, is really clamping down upon, is that he doesn't want any more of these freelance sheikhs because he thinks that that creates, you know, extremist ideas. So that those are some of the differences in the educational system and also in how the faith is expressed to followers, to worshipers.
So it sounds like with the Shia, there's a higher level of academic rigor, if I could put it that way, or more control over what people say.
At least in theory, yes. And and for the most part in practice, certainly in Iran. In a country like Bahrain, for example, it's less so because the religious establishment is very much involved in politics, but there's a struggle with the government. So in Bahrain, for example, where we had a Shia-led uprising, and we still do since 2011, the Shia clerics are very much involved in politics. They're sort of leading the uprising to some degree, and a few of them have been put in jail as a result.
Can we say, Genevieve, that Shia or Sunni, one of these is more open to a Western outlook?
No.
No.
To be very simple, no. I mean, we tend to, excuse me, have this idea that, you know, that Islam is a backward religion. I mean, that's one of the stereotypes that we hear on the TV all the time on, you know, look at the presidential campaign, for example. And that's really an oversimplification of what the faith is about. It's a very modern faith. There are some groups, there are some Muslims all over the world who believe, for example, in sort of maintaining the traditions from a long time ago. But Muslims live in the modern world. I mean, there's some of the greatest technology has come from the Middle East. They're great scientists. They're great engineers. They very much live in the modern world. And so I think it's really very misleading to talk about the religion as being backward. It's conservative in some places. It's socially conservative in some countries. In Egypt, for example, Egypt has become very socially conservative. When I lived there in the 1990s, for example, that's late 1990s. I lived there 4 years. That's when even school children started wearing headscarves. So when I would go in the afternoons on the street, say at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I would see all these little girls with uniforms wearing headscarves. That in those days was shocking. Now it's much more common to see this in the Arab world. But that's social conservatism. And so I think we have to be careful. That doesn't mean that they're backward. It means that they respect modesty, that women believe that this is important for their faith. And so that's, I think we have to be careful about how we label the faith.
All right. Lots more questions down that line in just a moment with you, Genevieve. And we'll start taking your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More on the Sunni Shia divide in the Middle East in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Our guest this hour is Genevieve Abdo. She's a fellow at the Atlantic Council, also at the Brookings Institution. She's worked at the UN on an initiative to improve relations between Islamic and Western societies. She was a foreign correspondent for 20 years, focusing on the Middle East. She's author of three books on the subject of the Muslim faith, with a new book on the Sunni-Shia conflict due out in December. Genevieve Abdo is here in New Hampshire as part of the World Affairs Council's Spring Global Tipping Points program. And let's hear from you this hour. We're focusing on the Sunni-Shia divide, trying to understand it, including not just the religious background, but the role that it plays in the conflicts that we see in the Middle East today. We welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. And Genevieve, before the break, you were talking about American impressions of Islam as a backwards religion, to use the word that you use. But you said that's not the case. It's just socially conservative. I'd love to hear from you a little bit more on what other impressions Americans hold of Islam and whether they are accurate or not.
Well, I think Americans certainly hold positive images of Islam. Unfortunately, those aren't the ones that are emphasized. And especially as we listen to Donald Trump and others on the campaign trail talk about banning Muslims from the United States and all these very unconstitutional and really racist, if I may say so, comments about minorities, not just about Muslims, but all sorts of other people. I think that we need to understand that religious expression doesn't equal backwardness. So as we have become, I think, as Americans, more familiar with Islam after 9/11, as people in this country, the Muslim population grows, there are approximately anywhere from 3 million to 6 million Muslims in the United States. The number is very much debated, but I would say it's probably closer to 6 million. As people see women in headscarves in supermarkets, which we do all the time, on the streets, in schools, people form impressions. And I think it's important to realize that if you look at the history of other faiths, women wore veils. I mean, when I was a child going to Catholic school and the Catholic Church, we wore veils in church. We didn't necessarily wear them in public, but it is a form of modesty
and
for a lot of women.
Headscarves.
And
then
nuns wore habits.
Headscarves.
Exactly, and they still do. So I think it's important for people to understand the faith on its own terms, and that there have been – what's very interesting about the Muslim population here is that part of the younger generation – we don't know the numbers – but the second generation, in other words, if their parents came in the 60s, they had children who are now, say, in their 20s. They have become much more attached to their Islamic identity in some cases, in some cities, than their parents. So if a daughter wears a headscarf, maybe her mother didn't wear one. If a son goes to an Islamic school and attends mosque more frequently, probably his parents didn't do that. So this has been, I think, somewhat of an adjustment for Americans, because it's not only that they're reading about Islam on the news, but they're seeing it in their daily lives. And some people are more receptive to this than others. But in my experiences in researching mosques in the United States, what I found, even in, say, a very conservative mosque in Dearborn, Michigan, which is where a lot of Muslims and Arabs live, these people come from Yemen, for example, and they look – they wear traditional dress. The women wear headscarves. It's basically you feel like you're in the village again. When I was there doing research and they gave tours to just normal people in the community, not Muslim, they would invite them for Ramadan. They would give them tours of the mosque. Suddenly they became much more open-minded about this community, this Muslim community, because they realized, well, they're just talking to us about their religion. They're not extremists, even though they look a bit scary. And so I think that it's a matter of education, and it's a matter of becoming much more familiar with the Muslims living in your community.
You know, as we talk about the Sunni-Shia divide and get a little more informed about the role that it plays in these Middle East conflicts, what about American Muslims? Is there a Sunni-Shia divide here in this country?
Interesting question. There are Shia who live in the Dearborn, Detroit area, and there are Shia mosques. And that's probably the largest concentration of Shia. I haven't been there for several years since I did write a book on Muslims in America, but I'm told by people I know there that the tension also now has developed inside this community between Shia and Sunni. And I think the reason, Laura, that your question is important is not just because we're talking about the conflict, but the bigger issue is that what happens in the Middle East, what happens globally, happens in America. And there's no way to avoid that. So if there's going to be a Shia-Sunni conflict in the Arab world, it's probably coming to the U.S. if the same people and the same communities live here. It's the same way that some Muslims here are becoming more religious. Why? Because they're becoming more religious in their countries of origin. So we have to acknowledge, I think, as Americans, that we live in a global community. Our proximity, unlike the Europeans, isn't, you know, so close. We don't live near these countries. People generally don't immigrate in these large numbers, as we see refugees and people just taking over Europe. I mean, you know, in large numbers coming to Europe. At the same time, I think that Americans have to acknowledge and accept the fact that you can't cut off. What happens globally is going to happen here.
What do you think is the most important thing, Genevieve, for Americans to understand about this Sunni-Shia divide?
One important issue is that there's nothing Americans can do about this. If you ask a lot of people in the Middle East and many scholars who write on this topic, I think there's pretty much of a consensus that the invasion of Iraq was very, very instrumental in causing this conflict, which, as we discussed over the last hour, has a long, long history, but escalating the conflict. Because the United States invaded Iraq, they ousted Saddam Hussein, as we said earlier, a Sunni leader, and they helped put in place a Shia-led government. The second Shia-led government is now ruling Iraq. And what the Shia did, much like Saddam Hussein, is suppressed the other community. So the Shia suppressed the Sunnis in many ways the same way that Saddam repressed the Shia. I'm probably not to that violent degree. So I think that even though the United States has inadvertently, okay, certainly it wasn't intended. I don't think so. I don't think George Bush intended to put a Shia-led government in power in Iraq. No one even thought that far ahead at the time. But the result of the U.S. invasion started this conflict in Iraq, which then spread to other countries once the Arab uprisings happened because the states started failing. So the dictators that used to be able to crush this conflict had less power or weren't in power anymore. And the people then themselves decided that they were going to debate this themselves in on all different levels and all degrees. But I think it's important now for the United States and Americans to understand this is a Muslim issue. They should probably not get involved. I think that's the first point. And the second point is that, unfortunately, unlike the political conflict, and you asked, Laura, in the beginning, is this about politics or religion? And I said both. Unlike the political conflict, for example, how much territory is Bashar al-Assad going to retain in Syria? How much territory is ISIS going to gain in Iraq? Those are political issues that at some point in time will be resolved, right? ISIS will either be destroyed in some way, not destroyed, but the religious conflict, unfortunately, probably will continue for a long time.
So was the Iraq war and the breakup of Saddam Hussein's regime, and then, as you said, it spread to other regions, weakening other dictators, was that the sort of gasoline on a slow-burning fire?
Yes, it was the gasoline on a slow-burning fire. Because if you look at other events, okay, say in the last 50 years, the Iranian Revolution, which we talked about.
Sure, there's been conflict long before
the Iranian Revolution.
The United States went in.
Was
to
a shock, right, to the Middle East, because a Shia government, a religious Shia government, was now the state. The Islamic Revolution. That's what it was about. It was about putting a Shia government in power. This was a shock to the Sunnis. The second big event that happened during the last, say, half century was the Lebanon Civil War. Okay, that's where my family comes from, Lebanon. There were many different religious communities involved in this war, including the Shia and the Sunni. So this also sent shockwaves. So it was, as you mentioned, sort of this simmer, low boil. But the Iraq War lifted the lid on all of this in a big, big, big way that people say is greater than in any other time in history.
Let's go to our listeners, Genevieve, and then a lot more questions. Again, the number for you to join us as we look at the Sunni-Shia divide in the Middle East, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest is Genevieve Abdo. She's the author of three books on the subject. She was a foreign correspondent for many years. Today, she's a fellow with the Atlantic Council and also with the Brookings Institution. She's here in New Hampshire as part of the World Affairs Council's Spring Global Tipping Points program. Again, we'd love to hear from you this hour. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Jeffrey's calling in from Peterborough. Hi, Jeffrey. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Good day. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
I wish to simply point out that the historical background of this dispute has been exacerbated by the fact that the Ottoman Empire, which was founded by the Ottoman Turks, which is now, of course, the predecessor of the present-day Turkey, when it became ruler of the holy sites, had to legitimize its warfare on other Arabs as opposed to its warfare on Christians by having a means to identify those people that it saw politically and militarily their enemies. And these were the Persians, what we now call the Iranians. And so for a good 600-plus years, the Persians were the heretics, and this heretic part of Persia was, of course, that they were Shia. And so this conflict has been fueled by a long tension caused by the heretic position that the Persians and the Shiites have held.
Well, Jeffrey, I'm so glad you called and talking about the Ottoman Empire and so forth. You're right. We could say, okay, when did this really start? And you could go back 10 years, you could go back 20 years, 30 years, you could go back 100 years. We also have an email from Amy, sort of related to what you say, Jeffrey. Would your guest please explain how the borders created by European countries in the post-World War I Middle East exacerbated the Shia and Sunni conflict? So both listeners, Genevieve, trying to go back much further than we've gone back to these borders that were created by the European powers.
Yes, terrific questions. Thank you very much, and very knowledgeable, in fact. So this year, actually, is the 100th anniversary of what is called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was agreed upon in 1916, and both callers have alluded to this. This is when the European powers carved up the Middle East. And we continue to refer to this now, 100 years later, for a lot of reasons. I mean, one of which is that ISIS claims that one of their primary objectives is to undo these borders, that they often refer in their literature. There is a magazine they publish called Dabiq, and they refer in other forms of literature to them. Well, of course, they have a lot of propaganda they issue, but one of the arguments they make is that's the problem. The problem is we were never meant to live in nation states, because that's the terminology that was used when these countries were created. They created nation states, which a lot of people in the Middle East think is a Western concept, okay? Western thing that has nothing to do with them. But at the same time, I think that even if today you told the Shia and the Sunni, okay, you can have your own countries, carve it up. It's most people in these countries live side by side. And I think that that's something to remember. And the reason that, at least for Arabs, this is a very tragic period is that they can remember when there wasn't a conflict. So even though their countries were carved up artificially, even though dictators were put in place by the West that weren't necessarily representative of their interests, the interest of the whole population, still, in many countries, in Lebanon, for example, where my family is from, before the Civil War and even historically, people didn't really segregate themselves along these religious lines. Even in Bahrain, which now is very segregated after the uprising, there was intermarriage there among Shia and Sunni. I know a couple, for example. The husband is Shia, the wife is Sunni, even now. So this is part of the tragedy, is that at some point in time, even in these countries that are now mired in conflict, people did live peacefully together.
That's what's so sad about it. And it wasn't right. that long ago where you did hear about, you know, neighborhoods being mixed, right. people intermarrying. So again, it makes your average person here in this country go, well, what happened? It's so sad.
Yes. It's sad because, you know, I think that there are a lot of forces, not only I want to place sort of the blame equally on different factors. It's not just the Iraq War. Okay. But it's also part of the simple fact that religion and religious identity has become more important in the Arab world. That's why you have even a group, if listeners remember, after the revolution that ousted Hosni Mubarak, it was the Muslim Brotherhood who won the presidency, who came to power in Egypt in a free, fair elections. Why did this happen? Because Egyptian society had become more religious. So that's another reason that the conflict has become so important.
That's another why question, Genève. Your statement that religious identity has become more important to the point where people don't feel as comfortable maybe intermarrying or living side by side. Why is that? Why has religious identity become more important?
Some people have written, a lot of scholars have written, that it's the failure of nationalism. So if you look at the 1950s, okay, when Arab nationalism was sort of an identity that permeated the Arab world, that to some degree left, vanished, and what replaced it is an Islamic identity. I think that's an oversimplification. I think that it's more about what nationalism meant for people. So nationalism was always associated with dictators, okay? Assad, Mubarak, all these people that dictated populations in the Middle East. But when people became more determined of their own self-destiny, they decided they would choose. And I think that that happened at the same time that Islamic groups became powerful beginning in the 1970s. And certainly that's true of a country such as Egypt and other countries in the region.
All right. Lots more of your questions and comments after a short break. Amy, thank you for the email. Jeffrey, thank you for the call. 1-800-892-6477 again is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More with Genève Abdo in just a moment on the Sunni-Shia divide. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're focusing on the Middle East and the Muslim world, especially the Sunni-Shia divide. Our guest is Genève Abdo. She's a fellow at the Atlantic Council, also at the Brookings Institution. She's the author of three books on the Middle East, including a new book on the Sunni-Shia conflict due out in December. She's here in New Hampshire this week as part of the World Affairs Council's Spring Global Tipping Points program. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Genève, right back to our callers. Rob's joining us from Concord. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Good morning, Laura, Ms. Abdo. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I gather a theme has been looking at the authority, both religious and political, for the different sects in Muslim. And my question was to ask you to reflect on the role for the individual Muslim in interpreting the Quran and in interpreting their own faith rather than having to rely on an external authority.
Thank you for the question, Rob. Go ahead, Genevieve.
Thank you. It's a very important question. What has happened is, especially after the Arab uprisings, is that people rely a lot less on these sort of authorities, as we call them. I did talk a bit about Iran, and I talked about the Shia authority, but there's also a Sunni authority, one of which is a very historic authority. It's called Al-Azhar. It's in Cairo. It's existed for centuries. It's a mosque and university complex, and that's where a lot of the Sunni clerics are educated, the Sunni religious scholars. And for many years, the Egyptians, for example, because it's based in Cairo, not only Egyptians but other Sunnis, they would take advice from this institution. But what happened is that authority became much more dispersed after the Arab uprisings. As states lost their authority, so did state-sanctioned religious institutions lose their authority. So even now, there's even more of this kind of ability and willingness for people to interpret the faith for themselves, or to go online, or to look for references that they want to believe in, people they want to listen to, whether it's sheikhs online on Twitter, whether it's people with television programs. I mean, you know, there are millions, not millions, but thousands of preachers who have programs.
So it's much more fractured.
It's much more fractured. You can call in. There are, you know, one of these Salafists in Saudi Arabia. He has a weekly television program. Just call him up and ask him, you know, what is your advice about this or that? So it's become, I guess we can say, it's been democratized. So religious authority and how the faith is practiced has become a much more democratic process. You can participate, you can not participate, you can follow this person or that religious scholar, it's sort of up to you.
So when people in this country say, well, you know, Muslim leaders need to speak up and, you know, denounce this violence in the name of Islam, it's to the point where you seem to be saying, which Muslim leaders?
Exactly.
There is no sort of one voice like the Pope.
Exactly. And that's the problem for them. So the problem is people do speak up in the United States, Muslim leaders. They do every day. I mean, you can go on websites, you can turn the television on. They do speak up. But there isn't a centralized authority. So some people listen to them, some people don't. And also, you can't say that there is one religious figure who speaks for all Muslims. So, and the faith is interpreted by many people in different ways. And so that's both the richness of the faith, but in sort of the modern times, it's caused some problems too.
Let's go to Kevin in Bedford. And Kevin, thank you for calling in. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Thank you, Laura, and welcome to the speaker. This is groundbreaking radio in New Hampshire. So glad to hear some of these things that you're saying. Like,
thank you.
The Muslims are here. They're part of America, and more are coming. So my question is, two of them. One is, how do we get them to assimilate more into our society and, you know, like the First Amendment? And in places like Michigan and Minnesota, I hear rumors of Sharia law and enclaves where I, as a Roman Catholic, couldn't walk through it. And if the Muslims are coming more and more, are we going to have more and more of that, which I think is totally illegal in the United States?
Kevin, and when I'll you say First Amendment, what do you mean there?
So I saw a YouTube, and I don't know, you know, that you can make some of this up. Some Christians, Baptists specifically, went to a place in Michigan and stood on a corner outside of a block of Muslim folks. They were having a festival, and they had Christian brochures saying, come and, you know, come to our church, come hear about Jesus. Jesus is the one. And it was a filmed confrontation where, you know, these people, the Muslims came over and were ripping these things out of their hands, and the police had to intervene. It was the only one I saw, but it worries me that in fact, is a faction of Muslim. We see it in the Middle East, and we don't want that here in the States.
Kevin, thank you for the call. And go ahead, Genevieve, a couple points that he brings up. The idea, first of all, it seems like he seems to be saying there are conflicts over there. We don't want that here.
No, very good point, Kevin. And I know that New Hampshire is a very tolerant state, so I'm glad your question is about tolerance. Anytime a different religion, a different ethnic groups emigrates to America, right, there's some adjustment. And I think that we have to keep in mind that there needs to be tolerance on both sides, not just on the Muslim side. So Muslims have to be allowed. I don't know the particular incident that you're referring to or even if this video is authentic, but I think that there has to be tolerance on both sides. So as I mentioned earlier, as more and more Muslims immigrate here, and they are immigrating here, and the population will increase significantly by the year 2025, according to projections, Americans have to be more tolerant of how Islam is expressed publicly. And I think that this is very important. I don't know about your references to Sharia law. Now, I will say, though, that in the UK, there is a movement for Muslims to be able to be to have their cases adjudicated in Sharia courts, which is, you know, it, religious law is different than civil law. And for example, if you want to get a divorce, if you live in the Middle East, you may get a divorce in a religious court because that's the laws are different. The inheritance is different for women. The custody issues are different. So if that's your faith, then of course you might want to be have your cases tried and decided by religious codes, not secular civil codes. I don't know if there's any sort of movement about Sharia in the United States. But again, I think that, you know, a lot of these words seem to create alarm because of how they've been defined and their associations. But we have to get away from these kinds of more alarmist ideas about, you know, Sharia. And Sharia is Islamic law. It's nothing. It's can be applied in extremist ways, but not necessarily.
You mentioned, Genevieve, Americans need to, in your words, tolerate expression of religion as Muslims immigrate here. Kevin mentioned the word assimilation, and that's an American value as well. So how do you make that work? And I know this isn't just applying to Muslims. I mean, we've seen this with other groups coming to this country in our history.
Well, Laura, that's the challenge. And the big challenge on this particular group that is coming here is that they are held responsible for what happens in the Middle East. And they're associated with what happens in the Middle East. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be replayed here. And I think that
if that seems to be Kevin's fear, is that it will be replayed here.
Of course. But I don't think that we should assume that. And if you consider, for example, I mean, look how many years have passed since 9/11. There have been some terrorist attacks in the United States, but in the scheme of things, not so many. And most attacks were not carried out by Muslims born here. And I think that's the other thing to really keep in mind, that the Muslim community has assimilated, integrated, whatever terminology you want. They have high incomes. They have high levels of education. And they have integrated in far greater ways than Muslims have in Europe for a lot of reasons.
Was the Santa Barbara shooter, the man in that couple, he was an American citizen.
But
I can't remember if he was born here
or
not.
But the wife was not from the United States.
Yes, the wife was not from the United States.
Right.
Let's go back to our callers. And again, Kevin, thank you for that one. This is Mohammed, also calling from Concord. Hi, Mohammed. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. How are you doing? Good morning.
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 I have two questions. The first one, was the problem maker in the Middle East Islamic Sunni or Shi'i? And the other question, what's the dangers of the word Islamic Sunni or Shi'i? And what do you think, what's the best for United States help the Sunni or Shi'i to base in the Middle East and the world?
So what's the problem maker, first of all, in the Middle East, Mohammed, Sunni or Shia? And your second question was again, please?
What's the dangers in the world, Islamic Sunni or Shi'i?
Okay. And Genevieve, probably hard to answer,
thanks,
but
Mom,
I appreciate the question, and it's probably one that other people have. Right. You know, if we're going to worry about one or the other, which one should we worry about?
Thanks, Mohammed. I think that it's difficult. I don't think we should look at it that way. That's my view. We shouldn't say who's to blame, who's the culprit, who's worse, the Shia or the Sunni, because it's complicated and it's – and in different countries, there are – the conflict has been started. I mean, I'll use Syria as an example, okay? It, you know, there was an uprising in Syria. It started as a movement for more democracy. It started as a movement for justice.
Against dictatorship.
Against dictatorship.
Assad.
Absolutely. Against
so it was a political movement.
It was a political movement. What did Assad do? He escalated the conflict. He released extremists from jail, so Sunni extremists from jail, so that then he could say, oh, but look, this isn't about me. This isn't about a lack of democracy in a very repressive society. It's about extremists. And do you want these people taking over your country? That's why you need to support me. So in Syria, Assad has been very, very instrumental in escalating the conflict. So in my mind, he's the culprit. And as we were discussing last night, a Syrian brought a very, very important point up in our event last night at the World Affairs Council. He said, asked the question, why is everyone always focused on the atrocities and the murders and the terrible things ISIS does? Assad has killed more than 200,000 people or been responsible for killing more than 200,000 Syrians, many more probably. And so I think that that's a legitimate question in a country like Syria. And every country is different. So I think that we have to look at the sort of sequence of events in many of these places. And in most countries, I would say both sides are at fault.
So to answer Mohammed's question, it's not so much about a religion, Sunni or Shia. It's about, you know, powerful men in this region wanting to hang on to their power.
Yes.
Okay. Mohammed, thank you very much for the call. Let's take one from Manchester. Jim joins us. Go ahead, Jim.
Good morning, ladies. A great and fascinating conversation. I would just like to caution, though, that in the conversation we've had this morning, especially when talking about Muslims in America, words have been used like Americans need to be more tolerant of Muslims, that Muslims will be moving here over time, and by a certain year there'll be a larger number. I think that's a problem because it's a terrible disservice to the millions of Muslims who have lived here for centuries. And so to make the word American synonymous with non-Muslim is an error. That would be my thought.
Well, sure. And we were using it as a shorthand, but you're absolutely right to call us on it. This is a diverse society, including Muslims who've lived here for a long time. Thank you, Jim. Your thoughts, Genevieve?
Thank you. That's a very good point. And I was talking more about recent Muslim immigrants because, of course, let's not forget that the original Muslims were African-Americans. They became African Americans. The original Muslims in the United States were blacks. They were not Arabs. So your point is very well taken. Thank you. And there's always been a very active African American Muslim community, for example, in Chicago.
How is that more longstanding, well established African American Muslim community working with or not working with the more recent Muslim arrivals?
It's hard to say. There have been a lot of efforts since 9/11 for these different organizations to work together. And I think also there the Muslims who were, say, from Arab world and other parts of the world, they felt some comfort that they received from African-American Muslims after 9/11 because, you know, they said, well, look, you know, we've been sort of discriminated against for all these years and now it's you. So let's team up together. But politically, there are a lot of differences, so they don't often have the same interests. But there has been much more cooperation, certainly since 9/11 than there was before 9/11.
So here's my last question for you, Genevieve. Okay. And it's a hard one. You ready?
Oh, no.
You said earlier that when I asked you what's the most important thing for Americans, meaning everybody, and Jim, thank you again for that call, to understand about the Sunni-Shia divide. And you said, well, one of the most important things for us to know is that there's nothing this country can do. What does that mean then for American foreign policy? Do we just pull out, pull back and say, You guys figure it out?
That was probably an overstatement on my part. I wouldn't say there's nothing we can do, but I would say that the kind of intervention that we have seen from different U.S. administrations is probably not the right approach. But I'll just give you an example.
Sure.
For example, one of my colleagues in Washington, he works for a new agency within the U.S. State Department called Religion and Global Affairs. That's not the official title, but that's the idea. Can't remember the official title. And they are working, for example, with different communities to try to bridge the Shia-Sunni dialogue sort of on a very community grassroots level in some countries. So there's the government is doing things, but what I was talking about is in terms of military intervention or in terms of the kind of grand scale involvement that we've seen in the past. I think that that's probably not such a good idea.
And working with Kuwait as a model, holding that up as a model, is that something else that this country should do?
Not really, because the conditions in Kuwait are so different than in other places.
Because of the economy there.
The economy, the makeup of the population, the history, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, Genevieve Abdo, we could talk a lot longer. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Laura. It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Genevieve Abdo, again, she's a fellow at the Atlantic Council, also at the Brookings Institution. She was in New Hampshire this week as part of the World Affairs Council's Spring Global Tipping Points program, talking last night at UNH Manchester about the Sunni-Shia divide. Genevieve's new book on that conflict is due out in December. Remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Araz Havan. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.